Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
It's Sunday the 24th of September. Autumn is finally here. Certainly feels like it. How's life in Florida, Kev? SeaWorld, Universal Studios, Disney, any others?
Yeah, just SeaWorld. We just literally did SeaWorld. So we've done killer whales, dolphins, seals, roller coasters, lots of food, lots of people speaking Spanish and Portuguese, and hardly any speaking English. Bizarre, but they're great. And then lots of shops, obviously, shops. These supposed outlet shops, which are not really outlet shops at all, they're just normal shops that happen to be selling it at supposedly significantly less. So yeah, full car on the way back, but here we go. All good fun, and the weather's been good. Just rained quite heavily a few times, but that's what you expect here.
No hurricane then, Hurricane Daniel or whatever, all the tail ends of any down there?
No, the weather's been good, and the hotel that we've been staying at is really kid-friendly, and the swimming pool's fantastic, and there's a big play area for the kids and a big area for them to run around in. So, yeah, no, it's been really good. And we're off to Savannah, Georgia on Friday afternoon after we've recorded this to do some more stuff, maybe beach on Saturday, and then we head towards Washington and head back to Cairo.
Okay, so, I mean, do you know what? Today actually marks the anniversary of...
Nope.
No, well, yeah, I'll tell you. Basically, the emergency budget. Do you remember the mini budget? Good old Liz Truss and her Trussonomics, where the day that she had the mini budget, which drove the pound to an all-time low against the dollar, causing chaos on the markets and obviously hiking up mortgage rates. I mean, I can't believe how quickly that's gone, but it's amazing how much of an effect that is still having on the UK economy, right?
That was 12 months ago?
Yeah.
That feels like it's 2 years ago in politics. Like, flip me, that's... I thought it was even longer than 1 year. But yeah, I mean, we obviously have recovered now. The dollar's 125 or whatever, but the dollar's become a lot stronger in the last few weeks, which is completely and unbelievably ridiculous, considering they're saying, or it looks like they're not going to raise rates very much more, if anything at all.
Yeah, I mean, that is the big headline, isn't it, on today's papers, is interest rates have now hit peak, predict the economists. Well, I'm not convinced, because obviously there's only that 0.1% drop in inflation, so I'm not sure that they've completely got a handle on it. And we've seen energy prices actually soaring, oil's up to nearly $100 on the barrel. We've got, you know, gas still very much high. We've got fuel at the pumps around the 160, 165 mark. So, you know, we're heading into an almost like an energy crisis again as we head towards winter. So I'm not going to rule out another quarter or another 0.5% rise.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Inflation hasn't gone away yet, you know, And I don't know whether this whole scenario to get rid of inflation completely or bring it down to this 2% is actually practical with this many different scenarios and headwinds affecting things. So
Rishi's saying he's got his target of 5, hasn't he, for the end of the year, and then obviously eventually for the 2% target, whichever, you know, they've put that on it. But you're absolutely right. I think 5's doable by the end of the year, but they'd have to be going at some rate now to get it under control. I mean, big factors affecting that. Loads of stuff well out of our control. Obviously, people blaming Brexit, supply chain issues, and also things like the Ukraine war, right?
Yeah, there's just amazing number of different factors. No economy and no situation can control just with a simple tool such as changing interest rates. And actually, really, all the interest rate does is what? It causes pain to borrowers, and subsequently consumption decreases because people haven't got money in their pockets.
Yeah.
So, I mean, ultimately, it just reduces consumption. So if it reduces consumption, that's supposedly going to affect inflation. But if those things are necessities, then often consumption isn't reduced. People just pay more for it.
Yeah.
So how much it's going to affect? I mean, obviously, it is affecting, but, you know, things can't go up...
I think they've got a handle on the food. They're saying they've got a handle on food price inflation and the cost of food. So there are certain items that do seem to be coming down. So let's hope, because that's obviously a big outlay on people's earnings, isn't it? Is the food, the weekly food shop, you know, has gone up from probably an average of £35 to £40 a couple of years ago to more like £80 to £90 or even £100 for you know a family of four, so if not more. So that has a massive impact. We alluded to it last week. Loaves of bread at sort of sourdough at £4 or £5. You're seeing it in the US as well. So what about, I mean, there's a very interesting one this week where Rishi came out, you know, good old Rishi. He said, basically, he talked about this, the government intends to delay a 2030 ban on new petrol and diesel cars. And basically, Downing Street was bombarded with calls from car manufacturers that threatened to withdraw investment in the UK after learning of these government intentions. So what do you make of that? One minute he's saying all cars from 2030 will have to be electric or an alternative, you know, hydrogen powered, not petrol. So a complete ban on petrol and diesel cars. But now he's moved the goalposts out to 2035. Yeah, I mean, I guess you could argue that it was impractical, wasn't it? 2030 was a big, ambitious target, really.
I think he's just told the truth, hasn't he, that it was never going to happen on 2030. So, I mean, will it be 2035? Will it be 2040? Will it be 2045? Will it be 2050? I think that's the scenario you're looking at. You're looking at anywhere between 2030 and 2050, which sounds a huge length of time. But actually, that's, what, 26 years from now. A car that's built today that is, if you like, not electric, so in other words, petrol in some way, shape, or form, it's going to last that long because they're well built now.
Yeah, 100%. So what do you make of these senior executives then at leading manufacturers sort of just basically threatening the government and Downing Street and saying they're going to pull billions of pounds of investment used to push ahead?
Yeah,
because obviously
what I reckon is the papers are trying, the papers and the online news are trying to sell stories.
Yeah,
is what I reckon. I mean, you know, without going too political, you can talk about what's been happening with that certain individual who's been accused of X, Y, and Z 12, 13, 14 years ago. Are they trying to destroy him because he's talking a different narrative than everybody wants to hear? Not suggesting he hasn't done it or he has done it, but they've cancelled him. They've cancelled him before anything's been proven, anything's been, you know, gone through a court. I mean, it's absolutely crazy.
That was on to the last story. The first question I was going to ask was what's happened to innocent until proven guilty was my first comment.
Doesn't exist anymore in this cancel culture that we have, especially as celebrities or people in the public eye. I mean, effectively, he's guilty, isn't he?
Trial by media, isn't it, effectively, is exactly what it is.
That's it. All done.
All done.
Personally, I think it's terrible from the perspective of he needs his day in court and for it to be done properly. And why shouldn't he be able to earn a living in the meantime? It doesn't matter really what the situation is unless he's immediately been arrested and thrown in jail, which he hasn't.
Yeah, well, as you say, he's unemployable now, isn't he? They've cancelled everything. His YouTube channel, so he can't earn any income from advertisement through there, which was rumoured to be certainly in the region of about £1 million a year, £100,000 a month, I've heard. He's lost his Rumble. So basically, they've pulled any digital platform that he can use for followers and for revenue generation. Obviously, his agent and all his current gig that he was doing currently that was live, I think he was in Windsor, the gig he was meant to be doing a couple of nights ago. They pulled that. So, effectively, they've decided that he shouldn't have a career anymore.
Yeah, don't like what they're doing, to be honest. And it has to be ultimately something to do with his current rhetoric.
I do wonder. I mean, I'm not
pretty much
conspiracy. I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but I do think there is some truth. And I wonder whether he, with the whole Me Too movement that happened around sort of 2015-16, whether when he effectively switched from being left wing, he was a big Labour staunch supporter of Miliband, and he actually helped him on his campaign many years ago. And then he's peddling this right-wing kind of anti-vaxxer type sort of rhetoric. And you wonder whether, do you think he's built up this number of followers to kind of like almost in a Trump-esque way to get support from people? And he knew that he was going to be pulled upon these things that happened many, many years ago.
Yeah, you don't know. I don't know that he knew he was going to get pulled up. But, you know, I think he has something like 5 or 6 million followers or that. I should say
11 million on Twitter, former Twitter, which is now X.
Wow. So, yeah, a lot of people following what he was saying, and obviously that reverberates around. And I liked what he used to say. And I mean,
what he used to say, but how he used to say it is very eloquent.
Very eloquent.
Very,
well, I mean, in a good way, as in looking at both sides of the argument normally, even if he sides with one in the end. So, yeah.
Okay, should we move on to this week's first guest?
Yes, let's move on to this week's first guest, which sort of ties in pretty well with SeaWorld, because this company is named after a very rare sea creature in Narwhal Marketing Group. So welcome, Luke.
Okay. So welcome, Luke. We're joined this week by Luke Sartain, CEO and founder of Narwhal Media Group. Welcome, Luke. Nice to meet you. First time you've been on.
Yeah, thank you, Phil. Thank you, Kevin.
No worries. So as Kev said, I mean, obviously, when you hear the name Narwhal, you immediately think of the toothed whale that possesses, I believe, a large tusk from a protruding canine tooth. So why the name, Luke?
Quite simply, we had a number of companies within the group, and the investors and the board really wanted us to focus in on who we were as a identity. And for us, as a organization, you know, we have the ambition that we wanted to be that kind of Silicon Valley-esque unicorn-style company. And I remember one of my team members saying, well, unicorns don't exist, but narwhals do. And we said, well, there we go. We're going to be called Narwhal instead. So, yeah. And it's always good to have an icebreaker with all things in life. So,
good talking point. And as you say, it makes perfect sense now with the whole unicorn thing, with the individual tusks. So, okay, I mean, let's start with a bit about yourself. And again, apologies if this information I have is slightly out of date, because obviously I've been having a quick look online at some bios. But I believe a serial entrepreneur by the sounds of things, reading that bio. But 34-year-old living in Bristol with your partner and children. And obviously back then it said in 3 years that you'd created a highly successful company with no initial investment and never spending a penny on sales and marketing. So can you elaborate and add some color to this, please, Luke? What's your background?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in a small town in Wiltshire. Self-taught myself to a certain degree on building websites, technology, coding. And I was also heavily involved in marketing and sales from a young age. I think I remember the first thing I did business-wise was scan a menu for the local takeaway and turn it into a website and try to sell them what would have been an early iteration of Just Eat at the time. People could visit this website. It would print out the order on an A4 piece of paper in the back office of the kitchen. And I think from that moment onwards, you know, I always had this curiosity and ambition to try new things and see what would work. So, but from there, moved on to college. Left college and at that stage left formal education. Once again, went down the more entrepreneurial route, packed my suitcase, moved across Europe to try and create what I believed would be a solution for the quite unruly at the time 18 to 30s industry by having wristbands which track the movements of individuals on bar crawls and unlock discounts at certain locations along the way. A lot of lessons learned from being a naive 18-year-old at the time and then moving back to the UK. Got heavily back involved in business. Spent some years as store manager in the glory days of the phone industry at Phones View and Carphone Warehouse, when those used to be pretty booming industries. Learned a lot there and then moved into building up my own company and my own agency, building websites and optimizing them. Trying to reverse engineer to a certain degree Google's algorithm to understand why certain pieces of content are visible and others aren't, and then monetizing that. So that's the point of not spending money initially. Everything was around the fact that when you search for a marketing agency, we came up top on Google and we didn't have to pay anybody for those advertising rights.
Brilliant. So it sounds like you're looking at, you understand the algorithms that a lot of these different companies use and social media platforms and the sort of SEO. And I know that changes quite frequently, doesn't it? They change you hear people say, oh, they've changed the algorithm and I've lost followers and I'm struggling to get followers and all these sort of things. So do you have a team of let's say IT bods? I mean, you alluded to the fact that you've done some coding and you really understand the way that these things work. But are you constantly having to delve deeper into these algorithms and code to try and, you know, just to keep up with the technologies, really?
Well, the algorithms of companies like Google, for example, can change dozens of times every day. So when somebody says, oh, I've lost followers or I've lost my position, it's typically down to a very small factor amongst many hundreds of different factors. And it's interesting, that industry is really interesting right now, because I think we're at the turning point of almost when we used to have online directories and using the Yellow Pages and then suddenly started using Google. You know, I believe that within the next 12 months, using Google is going to feel very, very strange. You know, I think the tools like ChatGPT and conversational artificial intelligence is going to replace the way that we search right now. I think it's had its day. I think that's why Google was holding back for so long on trying to release their own artificial intelligence to the public, and primarily facing it internally for medical purposes and other instances. But now they've been forced to show their hand because Microsoft has come forward and released ChatGPT. And, you know, what Microsoft is doing there is taking a slice out of Google's very, very dominant market share. It's around 90% market share. And Google's reaction is to release its own version, which, you know, realistically, I think even that Microsoft CEO said it's the elephant in the room. So everybody's blown away by ChatGPT, but I think everyone needs to wait to see what Google truly shows as its card, because I think it will be quite incredible. And when you factor that in with then the penetration of the Google Homes and Alexas into people's homes, and how many, you know, smart assistants we have on our mobile devices, it won't be that long until those devices can have that same conversation with you and learn from you. So
yeah, so here you are. So you've built this Narwhal Media Group, which I believe consists of a you know, number of different businesses. You've got Up You Go, which is a digital marketing agency. You've got Lasso Leads, which thinks data analytics and lead generation, and Gorank. And you can go into those individually in a bit more detail if you want later on. But What is it? How does Narwhal Media Group differ from other media groups that have got this kind of team of branding, marketing, and design experts? Why would they choose Narwhal over a different or another, you know, branding, marketing, design agency?
I think in total, as of right now, there's quite a few thousand companies using either our software or services around the world. So I think it's that big, large sweep of knowledge that you obtain from working on everything from small, medium-sized companies to some of our larger organizations like Hotel Chocolat or listed companies like SafeStyle Windows and many others who rely on this for everything, like you said, from data analytics, now security, as well as agency-related services. But I think it's more the fact that we try to be different in the sense that we are constantly forward-looking. It's a very fast-paced world out there right now, and it's very difficult to keep up with it, especially for large organizations who struggle to have that agility to move with those times. And that's certainly what we're seeing. You know, the company is made up of essentially three main components, which is our technology and software as a solution division and team. We have our leads and data, and then, like you mentioned, the agency side. But those individual core companies no longer exist. Everything is now just Narwhal and within those three core pillars. And they often overlap. So we'll be working with, you know, the largest solar panel company in the country, and we create technology to allow people to get quotations faster online without having to have engineers sent out to their home. But we'll also be working with that company on making the best use of their data, targeting specific regions where they need more sales, and also packaging up and automating that data to work in very particular ways. But once again, alongside that, we're trying to future-proof things by working with artificial intelligence to make these industries easier to work in. Everything from automating out-of-hours help desks to call centers. There's a lot of places which can be leaned up with automation and AI. And I think that's one of our core purposes right now.
So looking on your website, always a good starting place when, you know, trying to do some research into these companies. I believe that you had many investments over the years as a private company. And there was one investment in particular which sort of jumped out at me, was a gentleman called Imran Hakima, a former contestant on Dragon's Den, who invested, you know, nearly over £500,000 into your companies. So the valuation then was about 18 million, I believe. And I think it says on your website, you're targeting a 200 million valuation by 2024. Do you want to just add a bit to that and how you plan to sort of scale up the business over the next 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, absolutely. The core focus right now, and I think focus has always been part of the keywords used by not only the advisory team, but also investors, which is, you know, you can be great at many things at once, but if you focus on one of those areas and really overachieve in it, then that's where we'll get the valuation and what we're looking for. You know, the average marketing agency out there will typically be valued at around 1x annual revenue, whereas a company like Rightmove and company on the market, you know, weathers the storm when it comes to recessions and downturns, can be valued at 12x annual recurring revenue. And then we're targeting a modest 8x as a comparison between them all. And that's with us really betting on our comparison technology that we've been really focused on recently, which is going to be the main hub for all of our organizations and customers to interact with us on. It's essentially a digital marketing marketplace where a company can go on and say, I need 10 inquiries a day for my company. And within 24 hours, they'll start getting those inquiries at a fixed cost without them having to pay for clicks or impressions and other variables. You know, we trialed a soft launch of that software last weekend, from which we signed up over 500 companies in 3 days. Now, for every 100 companies that you sign up, and this is just in the UK, just in 3 sectors, for every 100 companies who sign up, it can add roughly £300,000 to £360,000 of monthly recurring revenue every day. So it suddenly snowballs very, very quickly. And then once you factor in rolling out into the US, Australia, EMEA, then you know the opportunity size is huge. We've grown about 700% since that investment came in revenue-wise as a company. We've stripped out a lot of the revenue from which we deemed agency related compared to lead or software related, because ultimately you get multiples and evaluation on the sticky data-led revenue rather than just handling somebody's Google Ad spend and it being vanity cash going through your company. So, you know, the stickiness of somebody using us for data and leads is very similar to SaaS, which is, you know, 90, 95% retention. Because once you're baked into an organization and providing them revenue, it's really hard for them to drop you without them seeing a huge drop in their own revenue. So it becomes very, very sticky and reliant that they need to use our services.
So Luke, tell me again, how do you make the revenue that is currently coming in, and how do you see Narwhal effectively becoming this narwhal or unicorn over the next couple of years?
So right now, as I mentioned, I mean, we're only in a handful, maybe 3 or 4 sectors in the United Kingdom, as we actually scaled back from last year to go from having multiple websites, multiple comparison websites, to one singular brand. So we have 3 main systems that we've been working on in the last 12 to 18 months. We have a back-end dashboard, which allows businesses small and big to sign up and say, I need X amount of leads per day in these regions with this style and persona of individual. So homeowners, or it could be over 65s, you know, it's up to the company and they can input that data and we will find them those inquiries in those regions. And then we have our front-end comparison website, which is actually being launched as we speak. We're running it some soft trials right now. That's called spotdiff.com, as in spot the difference. This essentially allows consumers to go onto a singular website, put in their information, sign up for an account, and then receive multiple numerous quotes from, in this scenario, the leading energy companies in the country, as well as a number of independent installers in the country. Now, for perspective, there's over 20,000 solar installers in the country, believe it or not, and increasing all of the time. Obviously, people relate to these services with just your Eons and EDFs of the world, which we also work with those companies. However, it's primarily huge demand from these independent installers across the country. That's the same with boiler installers, heat pump installers. And we obviously all know how important that's going to be over the next few years as everybody reaches for that net zero goal.
So what percentage of the overall leads of the United Kingdom, if you like, do you think you can control or get for something like solar panels or solar leads?
So based on government data on the volume of installs and knowing the conversion ratio of our customers, which is all really useful insights and data, obviously, we can predict even right now, we have roughly 30 to 40% of the entire solar market going through company in terms of then leading to an installation. The aim for me is to try and reach that 70% mark. But I think that happens with some brand building as well as enhancements on our technology, you know, the ability to use conversational AI once again to be comparison assistance for people who are inquiring late in the evening for a range of different services. Obviously, green technology is hot right now, but we also have other areas like hearing aids, private medical, from which are real pain points for consumers when it comes to having to deal with, let's say, prices which vary rapidly depending on which company you'll speak to, often with very little reason apart from commissions that are involved. So I believe pushing all of that pricing into the light saves consumers a lot of time and money, but also gives brands a platform, a better platform, a more reliable platform to buy inquiries and put their marketing money into.
So if you were to control that much of the market, then is there going to be an option, or is there already an option for you to supply the solar?
Well, you can see companies like Empow in Germany, which actually were a lead generation company, and now they are the largest independent, essentially, power station in the entirety of Germany right now, which is insane. I think the value to just had an investment from SoftBank being valued at around $3 billion, and 7 years ago, they were a lead generation company. So, you know, things can move rapidly and can drive forward. However, once you get into those realms, you're holding a lot of stock and inventory. You know, the beauty of our company is we can scale internationally and we can scale rapidly without inflating headcount. And, you know, that gives us a good amount of agility. So I would probably say we're going to have strategic partners and investments in certain areas. We did actually make an acquisition last year on a company which delivers windows and doors. And that was because we had a certain volume of inquiries that went through, which we couldn't place. So the logical thing to do is to sell it ourselves and make money from old rope. So that's what we moved into. Even that company doesn't hold any product. It's still matching an order using clever technology, which, you know, has been developed to a factory to get it manufactured and then sent out. So I think we'll continue to go down this dropshipping realm. We're just doing a couple of agreements right now with some leading solar companies to use our own brand technology and website to allow them once again to sell direct to consumer. So I think we'll see a lot more of that. But the aim for me is to stay agile and stay focused and continue to grow internationally.
So when you go through that lane, if you like, where you go in to have an agreement with the company instead of providing with them with a lead, if you like, you're now providing them with a sale. Is that actually more profitable for Narwhal?
On average, we can take, you know, around 30% margin from every sale that's gone through one of our platforms. But we typically be working on all levels. So, you know, a good way to put this is when you go to the supermarket and you buy a tin of, let's say, own brand sweet corn, and it's next to the Jolly Green Giant sweet corn. I mean, both sweet corns are probably made in the same factory. It's just surplus demand, which is then being white labeled and sent out. And
you should definitely use Heinz baked beans or tomato ketchup for this example.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, perfect. Yeah, 100%.
You know, should you buy Heinz baked beans, or should you buy the Tesco variety or the Asda variety or whatever?
Kev, there's loads of people pushing Branston beans. I'm not a massive fan, but I mean, like, that's a big name, surely.
Yeah, Branston is good. But close your eyes and try all three types and see if you can tell the difference.
It's a baked bean challenge.
Yeah.
No, I could tell the difference, I'm pretty sure. But at the same time, to pay twice the price for them, then that's a different issue, isn't it? But okay, so moving forward then, what sort of revenues are recurring at the minute inside Narwhal?
So right now, the order book looks at around 1.2 to 1.3 million revenue per month. And that's how much in terms of demand people are requesting from us. So we've launched a backend system which allows that mass sign up of individuals who are saying, I want to buy customers for my company. And then right now we're fulfilling around the 800 mark of that and increasing. So we expect that to fulfill completely. And it's a bit like a factory going up scale. We expect that factory to hit scale with the rollout of the new website, which essentially enables consumers to select multiple companies. So right now we're going, okay, we're matching you to X company, and that's it. However, consumers obviously want that comparison. So what we've launched now is we've matched you to this company, but here's a number of other companies that we work with within your region, which we also recommend. We'll have details on their reviews and everything else you need to know. And then the consumer can say, I want also to receive quotes from X, Y, and Z. And as soon as that happens, obviously our fulfillment barrel increases to capacity. And then we've got the inverse issue where we're going to have to go in there, get even more providers put back into the back end. But it's a nice problem to have. You know, the demand's there, the market fits there. You know, there's a lot of scope for pretty much every industry you can imagine, eventually, from oven cleaning to hearing aids to private healthcare to will writing to funeral plans. You know, we want to champion the things that you can't really compare. When you go back in time, you look at companies like GoCompare, they made the comparison market work by bringing forward all of the detail that everyone else was too afraid to bring forward. So all of the prices of the insurance companies were suddenly online and they had to work with them. And that's what we want to do for all of these other industries, whether or not it's someone's grandparent who's been ripped off by spending too much on a stairlift or a mobility bed. It's mainly because there's nobody pushing that pricing and that industry into the light.
Yeah. So from the perspective of the minute, you think you have a revenue generation of about £10 million a year, based on what you've said, the 800,000, but you have the potential for that to go to 15 million. But you spoke about much larger numbers when you talked about the number of companies that we're talking about. Yeah. I think you said £300,000. I'm not sure whether it was a week or month, but
that's a day.
That's a day. Wow. Okay. So if that is a day, that's £10 million a month, not a year.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the big challenge right now, which is changing from a conventional business, which is reliant on, let's say, a salesperson to sign up one business a day, for example, from calling and emailing, to having this automated sign up flow from which, even in, once again, the first 3 days, having 500 plus companies sign up. Obviously, the step change is huge. And we had to turn off that function temporarily, just as we prepare ourselves. We didn't expect it to be as in demand as it turned out to be, especially from only pushing out one channel advertising wise. So it really was validation that, okay, this is going to work. I've not completely lost the plot and spent the last 10 years building something which nobody was going to use. So it looks like it's going to work. Now let's make sure that we can handle that volume and scale. You know, you only have one shot, in my opinion, of making it work, not only with brands, but also with consumers. So we got to do right by both ends.
So from an investor point of view, over the last year or two, you've been taking money in as convertible loan notes, which once you do get listed, obviously will then become shareholders. But how do you see that process happening? And, you know, give us timescales without sort of tying your hands, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, first of all, I think myself, as well as many others, are looking at the market right now at everything from Arm to Klaviyo. And, you know, Klaviyo is probably more aligned with us in terms of the type of organization and industry that they're in, and seeing what happens in that IPO market. You know, we do have interest from investment banks who do want to take us down that IPO route. We are waiting until October the 12th to get a number of the investors and advisory board together to run through all of the analysis that we've done on the right route from here, whether or not that's taking a significant check from private equity to roll out into international markets, or it's right to go on the IPO route. I think the aim for here is to reach that 100 million valuation, which, you know, we think is going to be conservative based on certainly the volume and uptick that we can show, and then go, okay, let's take a breath and go again. You know, I think we're in a really, really lucky position in the sense that we've got the right industries for the right time. You know, we're in a space where things like data is extremely valuable, but also things like, well, anything involving the evolution into green technology, EV chargers and heat pumps and solar panels, which is what our core market is right now.
You're very, in the right place at the right time as well right now, aren't they?
Yes, massive.
With the latest announcement.
you know, so much confusion. You know, the government are flip-flopping backwards and forwards on, you know, what they're trying to roll out. And we're certainly seeing an impact on installers, on their confidence of moving away from boiler installations to investing in heat pumps. And unless somebody actually goes, okay, you know, we're sticking to it, we're going to carry on seeing delays, I think. So, you know, I think that's a separate topic.
Yeah, so basically you're going to have a decision to be made coming up, which will be, do we take a big lump sum of money, hopefully at somewhere in and around £100 million valuation from private equity, which will obviously then take a chunk of the company, and then you move and become much bigger before you then go IPO? Is that basically the decision? Or you go full blanche now, go IPO, and from the IPO, you'll obviously take a chunk of money as well into the company?
Yeah, I mean, look, if our maths is correct and we can sign up, let's say, 100 companies a day, which we believe is definitely possible now, and each of those companies on average want 2 inquiries a day each, then we you know, instantly add those very large numbers that you mentioned before. And profit-wise, you know, once that kicks in, it goes from a 30% GP to a target 70, 80% GP. And all of a sudden, you don't really need the cash and capital because you're cash generative straight away. So if all of this plays out the way that we think it will, then I think the likely outcome will be that we'll aim towards venture capital and private equity to then get significant working capital to roll out into the US, and then really go for that £1 billion valuation over the next 2 to 3 years. But obviously giving investors the opportunity to check out if they need to. I know that there's a number of people in the market, especially right now, from which, you know, are in various states of financial distress with everything that's been happening. So we want to give investors the opportunity. But, you know, I think most certainly that I've spoken to want to be part of that bigger journey to try and realize why we're actually called Narwhal in the first place, I guess. So.
Yep, sounds good. I mean, it sounds good. Obviously, it's going to take some patience from the investors who are already in. And yeah, let's see what happens. I mean, it'd be great to have a £1 billion company either on the UK markets or, you know, NASDAQ probably would be the real place, I think, to be. But regardless, as a British company, it's going to be exciting times ahead.
Certainly sounds exciting. So before you go, Lou, we always ask this question, certainly have done this season. What's the best advice you've ever received or heard?
Probably recurring revenue is king. I think that was one of my early CEOs who was a boss a long time ago. And I said to him, how can I start a company with no money up front? And he said, just focus on getting recurring revenue because it will weather you through the storm. I don't think anything's more true than that right now, which is get to generating cash and make it recurring, and then have the ability to swing back into profit when you need to. I think that's really important. So.
Brilliant.
And what's the worst piece of advice you've ever had?
That's a good question. I would probably say listening to too many people, whether that be advisors or others out there. I think, you know, the sign of a good entrepreneur is being able to have a vision in their head and stay true to that vision without having too much outside influence from people who may be playing it too safe or don't quite have the same vision. I think that's important.
Super. We'll send that note. Luke Sartain, CEO and founder of Narwhal Media Group, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, guys.
Cheers, Luke.
So our second guest this week is Ed McDermott, CEO of Seed Innovations. Welcome back, Ed. It's been a while. How's life treating you?
Hey, Phil. Hey, Kevin. Yeah, life is pretty good. Feeling up for it, so to speak.
So have you had a good summer and enjoyed a bit of downtime, or has it all been, you know, all stations go?
I say it every single year. Oh, you know, I'm going to take the whole of August off and all this sort of stuff. And it's just never happened. Not once. I haven't had a 2 week holiday since my teens, actually. And I did get away for a week with the kids. But as per usual, it was pretty busy and lots of calls to do. I think with all of our transactions and lots of stuff that goes on in the background with the portfolio, there's always something to do. There's always multiple conversations going on. I think I've probably said it before, but often by the time you see a deal happen, there's been 7 or 8 iterations of other deals across the portfolio that haven't got to the point of actually transacting. So that's the difficulty with these sort of things. And That's the job. I love it. Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, where to start, really? Obviously, since you've last been on, you've had quite a few updates to market, namely of late the sale of extra shares, updates on two portfolio companies, Northern Leaf and OTO International Limited, and also the recent share buyback program. Just walk us through some of this news, Ed, and how significant it actually is.
I think, as again, sort of to my last point, transactions are only relevant when you're actually transacting, you know, when it's an M&A situation, when there's some real funds being raised. Obviously, it's been a very tricky time in the market in general, and raising capital is really, really tough. And we can touch on that a little bit later. So in the case of Otto, that, you know, wasn't great news because we'd only recently had Southwest Brands acquired by Otto. And of course, their biggest problem is not the progress of the business. It's just capital availability and the valuations that people are willing to write checks at. So that wasn't great, but you know, they seem to be making a lot of the right moves operationally, which is the key thing. It's ultimately, we're not getting out of it. So it only really matters when it actually gets to a point of a transaction with that business. In the case of Northern Leaf, it's always disappointing when an IPO is sort of delayed, shall we say. But again, I think they were probably a bit optimistic about the timing at which they might get an IPO away. They've got a cracking facility over there. But again, you know, capital constraints has been tough for those guys. Obviously, Avextra was a good announcement. It made sense. We put in place sort of liquidity right at the beginning of when we made the investment. I was very, very clear with them that we needed to be able to exit for a number of reasons, partially because we're a listed company and anything that happens in Germany might not necessarily tally up with what Proceeds of Crime Act and regulatory systems over here in the UK where it comes to cannabis. There's just not always going to be a matchup, and in that case we might have to get out of certain assets. So it's always a, particularly in the space of cannabis, we always drive for that. Avextra is a really good company. We like the management. They're diligent, they're sensible, they don't have silly salaries, but obviously they're in a sort of pharma cycle. So, you know that can be quite a long road and very capital intensive. So for us to take some money off the table now and effectively get back the vast majority of what we've invested and still have essentially most of the profit riding is not a bad place to be. I and the rest of the board also believe that cash is king in a market like this. So it made sense to put ourselves in that position. And then, of course, we get to the buyback, which right now, with sentiment the way that it is across the market, with liquidity being pretty poor still, and I think this is not, I'm not referencing seed per se, this is just across the market. There will always be outliers. And someone clever will tell me of three AIM companies that have got loads of liquidity. That's, you know, they're the outliers. So it makes sense to use 10 to 12% of that, you know, over £7 million of capital to deliver some value back to shareholders in the shortest possible timeframe.
So just when you're talking about the numbers there, just give us an idea. What do you think the net asset value of the seed is as we speak?
So obviously our last net asset value was at about 16 million. I wouldn't be surprised if that was probably slightly down, but as when we were just talking prior to recording, I look at it in two different ways, and this is not investment advice, but you can't always look at NAV. What was NAV 6 months ago is not necessarily relevant to what NAV is going to be today. And again, let's look at the cost of capital. £7 million of capital right now, I think you'd have to give away £15 million of equity in something to get £7 million of capital. That is the that is the real cost of capital. Let's use an example. You had a £10 million market cap. You want to raise £2 million. You add your 20% discount or more onto that. You're already down £2 million. Then you've got the £2 million that you've raised. You've given away £4 million of dilution in order to get a lot less than £2 million when you start applying the broker fees, et cetera. So, you know, let's not forget 24 months ago, companies with £2-3 million of capital were trading at 5 and 10 times cash in the bank. So I'm not suggesting that that's how things should be now, but NAV to me is only relevant. It's a guide, as I said at the AGM, but it's not how I mark where we should be. So in my mind, we're trading at a huge, huge discount to where we should be. But again, that's not investment advice. That's just how I view it. And certainly a lot of other people who are, shall we say, city financially minded would view it as well.
Yeah. So you're looking then, the scenario is maybe the NAV is down a bit from your 16 million. And the market cap currently is what?
It's about £8 million as we speak.
Okay, so basically we're pricing in a 50% discount on NAV, if that is the case, and no upside in anything at all that you own, plus a large amount of cash. Is that fair to say?
I would totally disagree about the upside. I mean, upside, you can only, for us, from a net asset value standpoint, we can't price in what we believe an asset is going to go to. We have to do it based upon what was the last wrap fundraise, what was the last convertible loan note. So, for example, if you have a convertible loan note that carries a 25% discount to the IPO that it plans to have in a year's time, for example, is that a true valuation of where the company is? No, because you don't really know where the listing value is going to be. You don't know what they're going to achieve in that year. So, I mean, we can go through some of the assets that I think have a great deal of potential upside and, you know, look at some of the history of how those people have performed in previous ventures. Because that's probably, let's say, a more positive way to look at it.
Yeah, no, what I was actually saying was that I feel that there is no value accredited to the fact that these companies are real things and they're actually going to go up in value. So it was more of a positive comment that there's nothing priced in there.
Yeah, sorry, Kevin, I didn't...
He wasn't saying there was no upside in any of the investments.
Sorry, you got to understand, us directors, we've got to be defensive of our babies. But yeah, no,
I got his back.
We're getting less than £1 million of value attributed to what at our last NAV statement was, you know, essentially about £9 million of NAV.
Yeah. So effectively, you're going to be taking, the idea is to take off or repurchase about 21.5 million shares at a cost of no more than £850,000.
Right.
So, I mean, presumably that idea is you're effectively taking 10% of the outstanding, you know, the maximum outstanding shares off the market, in the premise that obviously that would help to, you know, bring the share price more in line with, you know, the real value, really.
Yeah, you're thinning out any sort of shareholders who are frustrated, understandably, who might have been holding for a long time, any sort of trader types, and you're just removing a bunch of shares, because obviously there's no need to have those shares available for replacing, because you've got plenty of cash. There's no need, you know, we don't have any need for capital. We're simply just looking at investments at this point in time.
So give us an example, Ed. I know it's hard to treat your babies all the same, but if you had to pick me the three top investments that Seed own that you think has the greatest potential, what would those be?
So I think probably let's go in terms of size at this point, because that's, you know, the things that obviously have some size to them already, that if they were to, you know, go up 50, 100, 200, 300%, whatever it might be, they would impact the value of the fund the most and give the shareholders most value. So we have obviously a meaningful position of Avextra. We have still about 45% of our total position. And that company is, as I said, doing a lot of the right things. It's got really good management in place. It's raised lots of institutional funds against the backdrop of very tough markets. Arguably, you might say, well, why did you sell some? Well, liquidity is important for us. I've made the point that we want to be trying to make our investment cycle as close to kind of 2 years as possible. And we're a little bit over 2 years. So for us to get some of our capital back makes a lot of sense. Let's look at Juvenescence. Juvenescence has been in the portfolio for a long, long time. It is a legacy asset, a Jim Mellon asset. That's how the investment was made in the first place. It has been a long road, but I think we should look at what those guys have done before. And when I say those guys, I mean Jim Mellon, Greg Bailey, some of the key figures who are in that business. Biohaven was a company that they were heavily, heavily involved with. It started out very similarly to Juvenescence, and it became, you know, very much a biotech play in the same way that Juvenescence has. Slightly different intended drugs, but ultimately they were all about, everything is about keeping people alive. And in the case of Juvenescence, it's about longevity. So Biohaven went to NASDAQ. It went very quickly to about a $3 billion valuation. And then they subsequently sold off that business for over $11 billion. So, and these guys have a huge amount of skin in the game. Both Greg and Jim have put in millions and millions of dollars each. So I think there's a lot of upside there. obviously it's going to be a patient wait potentially, but you know, each day that goes past, we're getting closer to some form of liquidity event with that. Now, that's not to say that it'll be a completely linear path to getting to an exit, but I have to believe that that is their next Biohaven. And again, that's just my opinion. That's not me leading anyone or suggesting that Duridescence is definitely going to be worth $3 billion, because that's not what I'm saying. But I do think it has.
You think it's going to be worth $5 billion? I think is that.
I think that when we get another cycle of biotech on particularly NASDAQ, I think it's going to be very, very big, because all the investment that's being missed into a lot of the companies over the last 2 years, that's 2 years of development with some really important products like gene therapy and all sorts of different cancer therapeutics. It's, it's a bit like mining oil and gas. When you don't have investment into the juniors, you suddenly have this big gap, and then, you know, big pharma, or in the case of mining oil and gas, obviously big mining companies, big oil and gas companies need to acquire their next pipeline of big producing assets. So I think we're going to see similar stuff happen when we get a bit of a turn. And I think that will probably be into 2024 realistically.
Yeah. So here you are, Ed, sat with about $7 million in the bank. Without giving too much away, what are you looking forward to or looking for in the future investments for Seed?
So we're looking at a couple of different routes. In terms of strategy, we can be quite broad with what we look at. It tends to obviously come back to a health, wellness, biotech, life sciences type feel. Obviously, Clean Food Group's another of our assets, which is sort of new to us in terms of sector, being a cell agriculture, precision fermentation play. That's not to say that that's the route we're going to go down with everything. We're going to go down the route of best-in-class assets where we can drive the valuation that we want, which is going to be, you know, less than what the companies want to give us. But ultimately, it's a capital-starved environment at the moment. And, you know, those companies, it doesn't come without risk, of course. But I think we're in a very, very strong position in order to be able to really support companies. You know, let's say a company wants to raise $3 million. Well, we can sort of drip feed that money as well against milestones. So we can say, right, we'll give you $1 million now. And once you hit the important things that you say you're going to achieve, we'll then give you another $1 million. And that's another way to sort of protect the shareholders. So these are, you know, it's all about how you structure investments. And, you know, I may not be the best investor in the world, but I definitely know how to structure investments well. And it's something that we're going to look to do. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on, whether that be sort of wearable devices for health and fitness through to, as I previously mentioned, things like Clean Food Group, where they're looking at, precision fermentation and using a yeast strain that is their own proprietary technology. But the key brilliance of it is that yeast strain has already been proven at industrial scale, whereas all the other yeast strains that are being utilized by its competitors are not. And again, this is not me suggesting that CFG is definitely going to make this kind of valuation, but the competitors, as in the companies that are, shall we say, similar to CFG, but they have a lot of differences as well, they all seem to have been raising money at around $100 million, north of the $100 million mark. So, you know, that's very encouraging. Again, it doesn't mean that we are necessarily going to achieve that. We may not. We may achieve greater than that. Who knows? But all I know is that the company is moving in the right direction. And then due to the fact that we've made that investment, we obviously are starting to see a lot more in that kind of space. We're also seeing stuff in gene therapy. You know, there's a really interesting array of things from very, very good people, which also, when I say good people, I mean good founders, good entrepreneurs, you know, scientists who have form, who have track records. But of course, with money being starved from a lot of the, you know, bigger, more traditional VCs at this point in time, it also allows Seed to punch above its weight, and also potentially bring in co-investment from other similar size funds. So we might be able to be part of, for example, a £5 million ticket and actually only write $1.5 million or $750,000 initially, for example. So, and then in terms of a shorter term trading strategy, that often will revolve around listed equities, where we believe that we can drive a lot of value for our investors, which they wouldn't be able to do. You know, they wouldn't be able to necessarily go and approach a company and say, hey, we'd like to give you some money on this basis and look at, you know, turning that money around quite quickly. But again, a lot of the important points about that will be the liquidity profile of that company, making sure that we are in a position where we know we can exit that company in a reasonable frame of time with a reasonable scale of money, but perhaps smaller quantums than we would typically use in our VCP strategy.
So, Ed, the two questions. The first question is, how much of this 7 million do you think is going to be used to finance, support the investments you already hold within seed? And the second question, I suppose, is how much of this 7 million do you pertain you will continue to keep for a period of time because you think it's going to get worse?
It's a very good question. In terms of part one of the question, our existing portfolio companies, we're taking a pretty tight approach with that. So where it comes to companies where we've already made an investment and, you know, they're at a point of very high risk. So for example, let's use Otto, where it's, you know, it's had a difficult time with liquidity and getting capital. We wouldn't necessarily write a ticket then. If they get to a point when perhaps they go for an IPO, we would potentially support that. So this sort of middle stage is not always the right time to come in. It's often the sort of pre-IPO that is the time to come back in. You come in early and then you come in late, if that makes sense. That's often where you get your best value, I think. Right now, most of the companies in existing in the portfolio don't really need a lot of capital, and certainly not from us. In some cases, they're going to be after much bigger quantums than we could deliver. So it makes no sense for us to be part of that. And especially if those checks are going to be written in a much higher valuation than where we've made our entry. In terms of, do we think things could get worse? Yes, definitely. Often when you see big interest rate hikes, huge inflation, difficult periods of capital, you're going to see a lot of companies across a lot of different sectors that are in growth mode either have to go into a kind of zombie phase or just die. So there could be a bit of carnage still, and it takes quite a while for it to actually filter through and for the market to effectively see it. So we're not going to rush that capital straight out the door. It's got to be for the right opportunities, and you know, we're sticking to our guns in terms of our criteria. There's not a lot of wiggle room for us for a company seeking investment to try and sort of twist our arm. Ultimately, you know, these are the terms, guys. If you like it, great. If you don't, it's not for us. So that's kind of going to be our approach. Yeah, well, exactly.
So how much of the 10% buying back on the market has actually happened? Has it begun? Are you halfway through? Are you nearly finished? What is the situation with the buyback?
So the exact situation with the buyback is our broker is doing the sort of final checks, because to cut a long story short, we have three different broking accounts with three different companies already. One of them, very last minute, after we'd agreed to do the buyback, started having an internal audit. I don't know exactly why, but that meant that they couldn't actually take any new capital in. We were only informed about this, you know, days away from launching the buyback. And the other two companies are not based in the UK, so they've got their own sort of trickiness. So we opened an account with our broker, Shard, but they've obviously had to do a number of different checks. I'm not totally sure why, to be honest, because we're a regulated and listed fund, but ultimately they've got to do what they've got to do. And I think that should all be sorted, hopefully today. So I would expect the actual buying to commence next week, and hopefully early next week.
Okay, so that's obviously going to, they're obviously going to, are you giving them rules that effectively they obviously can't just go in and mass buy on the market? They're going to have to buy as volume increases or as volume is available?
Yeah, so all the rules and the criteria are effectively set out at the beginning. So those are already set out, very, very clear. They know how to do these things. They're obviously a professional outfit and have done buybacks before, so I'm not concerned about that. In terms of daily volume, we can do a maximum of 20% of the daily volume, and there are also very, very specific rules around pricing. So it's not like a tender offer where they're just going to be sitting on the bid just buying up whatever comes in. It's got to fit within the criteria. So if you like it, it's kind of a supportive buyback, which it should be over a period of time.
And based on your 850,000 for sort of 10%, what is the maximum price that's going to go up to? Are we talking 4 or 5p, and then our loss will stop?
No, it will go up to 6p, and the reason we've set it at 6p, which is below our sort of current NAV price effectively, is because ultimately it's about trying to deliver value. So once and hopefully when we get above 6p, we won't be buying any shares back. But if it then dips back below, we would, you know, assuming there is still capital left as part of that buyback, we would then mop those shares up effectively. And I think it's important, you know, I think the sort of massive injection of a very quick tender offer type buyback doesn't really do what it's intended, because, you know, that can also be slightly manipulated, I think, by the market. And we don't want to have that kind of position. So it's got to be value to shareholders.
So this could take a while. Let's put it that way.
It could take a while. And the point is, because we've now actioned the buyback and we're not, you know, we have no more part to play in it. We can't change the rules or anything like that. We're now effectively safe harbored as a board, which means that if we could become inside on something tomorrow, it doesn't affect the buyback. It doesn't mean that the shares can't continue to be bought back. And that's important as well, because, you know, we need to be able to act fairly quickly if something really important and positive comes up. And so I'm hoping that, you know, during the buyback, we'll see additional investments made and the portfolio growing in terms of number of assets that we're invested in.
Yeah. You said that with your face very straight as well, which was very good. So I'm impressed with your ability to know exactly what's going to happen without actually declaring it, which is very good.
Well, no one can ever be absolutely sure about what's going to happen in this world. As you know, things change very, very quickly. And many, many times over the years that we've been doing this and investing, and this is both personally, but also through in the CEO role here at Seed, we've gone all the way up to the point where we're about to sign the piece of paper to make the investment, having done weeks and weeks of due diligence on it, and something changes at the last minute and that investment never happens. So, and that's happened as well with asset sales. So it's not always, the glory is actually very seldom in terms of getting the deal done. But, you know, that can be anything from
marketing. Same as selling a car, and it's not a done deal until the money's in the bank. Congratulations, Ed, on the cut. I can see over your shoulder. It looks like the Silverstone circuit layout, if my eyes aren't deceiving me. An award there, and a nice medal or whatever it is, trophy.
Very good knowledge, Phil. That is indeed Silverstone, and that was from the British GT Silverstone 500, which we were lucky enough to win. So,
brilliant. Congratulations.
Bravo. Anyway, he changed the subject, but basically there's a lot in the pipeline is what we're saying, because obviously you're a calculated man and we're looking at these things. We're buying back. There's probably going to be a good flow of deals hopefully coming. And the last time we talked, obviously different market, different situation, you were talking about market valuations, stroke NAVs of 50 million plus. You still believe this is possible within Seed?
Yeah, I mean, look, got to choose my words carefully, because I think a lot of people have taken that conversation completely out of context. Do I believe that, you know, we have the capability with the fund structure that we have and the board that we have to get a business to that sort of level? Absolutely. We wouldn't be doing it otherwise. You know, again, there are so many different variables in achieving that kind of milestone. And that obviously is time and how much money you raise. I've always said, and I stick by this, I want to try and achieve as big a net asset value and as big a market cap as possible without, you know, hugely dilutive action. And that's the key. So we really want to try and achieve it organically. And I think people would have seen over the years that there's been quite a lot of different investment companies on AIM. We're a little bit different than most of those, I think, in terms of this corporate governance that we have in place and the fact that we're regulated by the territory that the closed-ended fund exists in, which is obviously Guernsey. We have a former Nomad on our board. So we're pretty tuned into those things. But the goal has always been to get this thing as big as possible. And achieving that first big milestone of scale is always going to be the hardest bit. I think once you achieve that level, which, you know, might happen, it may never happen, it might happen in 5-6 months. You can't be sure as to when. All it takes in our case would be a mega result on something like Juvenescence, a mega result on something like Clean Food Group, or a couple of pretty good outcomes on these things. And suddenly you're edging your way up to much, much bigger numbers. But again, the goal is to continue making investments. We're utilizing a buyback at this point. That's only going to take up 10 to 12% of our cash and cash receivables. We're always looking to sell everything, but it has to be at the right price. And that's our view, you know. Some of it requires a lot of patience. Some of it you can turn around quite quickly. But for us, we just want to keep
demonstrating that we are able to bring cash back into this fund and then just try and do it at bigger and bigger scale.
Yep, it all looked good last time, and obviously markets are what they are, and it all looks good now, and it actually looks better than it did before. Obviously your buybacks is very helpful. The amount of cash you've got in a distressed market is for me, a very positive buying signal. And as you said, you do have some investments that could go exponential. Will they? Who knows? And that's basically the decision people have to make themselves about whether this is a good bet, if you like, in terms of your management structure and what's available within the market. So we wish you luck. I hope we can have a £50 million party, and that will be tremendous.
Yeah, I think I can promise you we will definitely put on a party for shareholders and close friends like yourselves when we get to that milestone, which I really do, you know, wholeheartedly believe we can get to. So it's just a case of timing. And again, please, shareholders, don't take that out of context. Don't take that as a guarantee or a promise. All I can promise is that myself, the board, we're going to work really hard. A lot of the board own shares, so we're aligned. Particularly in my case, it's, you know, it's a meaningful investment, and I hope that I'll be able to add to it in due course. I've already covered, you know, rules around that, and obviously capital availability, etc. But yeah, and you know, thanks again for having me on, guys. Really appreciate it.
Before we go, though, Ed, one question we ask now is: what's the best advice you've ever received or heard?
Very good. One thing I've always been told is, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And kind of it's true in every single walk of life. You know, you may feel beaten up some days. And, you know, Kevin was referring to how great the markets looked 24 months ago. And we were in this period of absolute elation. And then we've had the absolute opposite effect. And, you know, there were some pretty dark and miserable times for all of us at that. You know, in my case, it was, you know, soul destroying to see the share price get beaten up like that. But equally, I knew I couldn't do anything about it. I knew I just had to persevere through it. And I feel like I've got a bit of a new lease of life, as I know a lot of people do in, you know, unrelated things. And you just have to keep battling on. And, you know, it's never a linear path to anything. But yeah, I think definitely a marathon, not a sprint.
Brilliant. And what's the worst advice you've ever had, Ed?
Good question. I mean, I've been offered some pretty bad share tips over the years.
don't say any of them were from us, because it's probably true.
it's normally the cab driver, and you know when the cab driver has heard about
something. Five Bitcoin when it's at its peak at the pinnacle.
It's normally, yeah, you normally know that's a signal to be chopping out of things. I've had lots of bad advice, but yeah, I'm really fortunate. I know some. One of the things I did do over the summer, actually, and this is just the little anecdotal story, is go and spend a lot of time with, I've got some very, very, very successful friends who run, you know, FTSE 100 companies. And I've gone and spent a lot of time with them, you know, gone out for lunch with them just to kind of get their take on the market and what they're seeing. And that's been really, really helpful to be able to lean on that kind of knowledge and success history in many of these guys' cases. So you can really, and there were a lot of themes that came up over and over again. So yeah, that kind of stuff has been really useful to me. But I can't specifically give you one piece of really bad advice. Probably go motor racing, you know, go racing. That was probably a bad piece of advice. It's 95% disappointment and 5% is what keeps you coming, unfortunately. But yeah.
Just on that point, very last question. I know you've met up with the youngest CEO on the London Stock Exchange, Carl Somerton. What do you think of Chill? I know it's not in the same sector as you specifically, but what do you think of this vape situation and what's happened?
I really like Callum. I think he's a good guy. I think he's, you know, he's working really hard. I think he has put a lot of faith. He's got a lot of faith in him from the investors, and I think that's reasonably fair, to be honest. I think the vaping situation is very tricky. Any of these, it's not an area that I particularly love in terms of regulatory changes can make your life a real nightmare very, very quickly. And all it takes is, you know, a comment from an MP or something, you know, off the cuff, and suddenly your share price can get beaten up very unfairly, to be honest, because people become very fearful of something that's, but I suppose that's true of any industry. I think Callum's doing a good job trying to rebuild something that got quite broken by perhaps its former management, and also the fact that the market went absolutely crazy and valued something that had, you know, no revenue, no real brand at that point in time, at over 100 million quid at one point, if I recall, which was just bonkers.
300 million. 300 million.
Yeah, I mean, you know, good for those investors who bought low and got out high. But again, it was definitely a crazy time. So yeah, I like Callum, and I like the fact that they're trying to go down the route of sort of nicotine-free vapes. I think that there's definitely a market for that. I don't think it's something that's going to get sort of shut down overnight. I think there'll always be threats around these kind of things. It's really what you've got now is a business that needs to be able to, you know, become like an FMCG business ultimately. And that's a very, very difficult thing to achieve. It's very, very difficult to build a brand. So if he can do it, he deserves to get paid very, very well. That's what I would say.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And I think if it does be, or if it is built as a brand, as you say, then the multiples and the valuation will be exponential from where it is now, simply because someone's going to come in and buy the brand, and that's basically what's going to happen.
If it's successful, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I know a number of people through my time when I founded and built EMAC. We obviously had a very big consumer division, and that, you know, we did do vapes across some different markets in Europe, and very, very difficult. But along the way, I met a number of people who have built brands and sold them for 80, 100, 200 million to some of the big tobacco companies. And these are guys who built these things out of their bedrooms and gradually became, you know, serious companies. So it can be done. It's very difficult, but if you do it right, then, you know, you deserve to get the big multiples as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Good. Great to speak to you again, Ed.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, guys. Really good to see you. And hopefully we can have some more positive updates soon.
Very good. Yeah. Ed McDermott, CEO of Seed Innovations. Thanks very much for your time.
Cheers.
So what's been happening this week? There's been some quite interesting movers. The ones that stood out for me, Brez, Blencoe Resources, on Friday, they had a nice RNS, and they finished about 15% up, but it was 50%, you know, the same old market where sell on news. But basically, they secured a $5 million grant from the US International Development Finance Corporation, the DFC, to fund the Oran Cross Graphite Project's definitive feasibility study, the DFS. And what do you make of that? I mean, that's a hell of an achievement, really, isn't it, for a small cap?
Well, it's a great achievement, and surely there's got to be more upward movement than 15% for that. I know it was 50%, as you say, but, you know, finished below 5p, current market cap 10.26 million, and they're getting $5 million. So,
yeah. There's an upfront payment of $1 million, isn't it? And then subsequent payments, payouts contingent on achieving specific milestones, obviously, within the feasibility study itself. So, yeah, obviously, it's not all coming at once, but I mean, it's great to see that that someone has put together a partnership and how, you know, the involvement. Obviously, it de-risks the project massively, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, for sure, the government in the US are not doing it on the basis of they think there's no graphite there. So, I mean, I think it's just one that's going to run and run and run, to be honest. I'm very optimistic about it now that they've got a good portion of the finances in place. Anyway.
Sure. The other one, I don't know if you saw it, was Orca, Orcadian Energy, one we've covered in the past. We've had CEO on in the past, Steve Brown. And they've done, in the last 5 days, 300%, Kev. I mean, it's literally came out of the blue. It was almost like one of those when the government announced effectively, and Rishi, that they, you know, they were going to effectively rescind these North Sea contracts and licenses, they announced basically that there was a non-binding heads of agreement, an HOA, with an unnamed North Sea operator to basically potentially farm in on the pilot development project.
Yeah, I mean, to put it in perspective, it was priced to die.
It failed, wasn't it, really?
Priced completely fail. I mean, we were talking in the pence, and when we had Steve on, they were in the 30s, 40s pence range.
Yeah.
You know, for this North Sea oil project, which looks like it's potentially a goer. And obviously now someone wants to farm in, though it's not signed agreements at this stage. So when it is signed agreements, what we're going to go to? We're going to go to what we all talked about, which was probably a couple of pound it could be worth. I don't know, what did it finish on Friday in the end?
Around about the 14, 15 pence on Friday, but I mean, it was slightly higher than that. But I mean, it just looks primed to move back into, because it sat in the 20s for a long time, didn't it, as you say, and then it moved into the 40s at one point. I think the 52-week, probably not the 52-week high, but certainly the 18-month high has been as high as 38-40 pence.
Yeah. So, I mean, if it's signed, once it's signed, sealed and delivered and they're moving forward, then there isn't any doubt that the oil's there. It's how economic it is to get the oil out. Now, obviously, with oil stretching towards the $100 a barrel again, you know, it's going to look very interesting, isn't it? And if I remember from our conversations, the actual ESG stuff on this company is excellent. You know, they've put a lot of time and effort into making sure that this will have as little impact as possible on the environment, and you know, so it should be a good one, I think, in the long run.
Yeah, we've had some other movers this week. Sizzle looked like it moved quite well. Sizzle Biotechnology, we've had the CEO on in the past. Vacta had some news as well. They announced a successful completion of the sixth dose escalation cohort in the phase one trial evaluating the safety and tolerability of AVA6000, their novel doxorubicin therapy. So that one moved the stock quite well into the hundreds. I think, 127 was around the finish price with a market cap of 357 million. So one in the pharma space. There was an interesting one. I don't know if you saw the news on ECR Minerals. They'd shaken up the leadership team with the removal of the CEO and the addition of two key hires to help fund the progression of their exploration assets and provide working capital. ECR have raised or agreed to raise 580,000 by means of a placing this week, which I think is going to be obviously voted on. So that one looked like it may come back from the, you know, phoenix from the flames, really.
Yeah, what was the placing price?
So ECR announced basically that they're going to raise 580,000 by the way of a direct subscription model through the issue of 331 million shares at a price of 0.17 pence. At a price of 0.175 pence per share.
Okay, so pretty discounted, but they're going to have cash.
Yeah.
Okay, very good.
And also this week, as you probably know, I attended the Chill AGM. It was good to catch up with Callum, and obviously I met Jonathan and Ben and a few of the other investors up there, which was always good to do, to see the faces. What do you think of that? They had quite a nice strong finish, didn't they? I think they moved up from around the sort of high threes, early fours in the week up to about 4.677 finish.
Yeah, I mean, it's had a week of 20% rise, I suppose, but has been beaten down for really no particular reason, I think, at this point. But I think exciting times ahead. Things are starting to roll out in terms of the store counts in the UK. The US is also obviously starting to move forward as well. And I think watch this space. It's going to be exciting times over the next months and years, I think, as effectively, I think Ed said it, you know, he's basically trying to produce a brand. Yeah. If it produces a brand, you know, we've all seen what Red Bull did and all the other different brands, even like Fevertree, you know. So if we get Chill to become a brand, then it's going to be worth hundreds of millions, this company, as far as I'm concerned.
So do you mean in the sense of like an Elf Bar type brand, you know, a household name like that?
Yes. If it becomes a brand, then you're going to have people just wanting to buy it from the shops, and the shops just wanting to stock it, which is what I think is hopefully where we're headed.
Yeah.
How long that takes, how much money that takes, et cetera, is supposed the imponderables. But, you know, as Ed said, this company got 200 something million pounds on fresh air before, because of the way that the share structure is created, and obviously the belief people had. I don't think it's going to go there anytime soon unless it produces, you know, sales figures and results this time. Yeah, they're selling. We know that for sure. They're selling. People have had pictures of them in the shops, and, you know, half the box is gone already and stuff like this. So we know that there is a demand. And I think it's just hitting the thing at the right time, to be honest. All this negative press about vapes and effectively the nicotine and getting addicted to the nicotine. Well, here's your solution. Here's a vape without nicotine, decent flavors, and, you know, try them out. You might enjoy it socially. And also you should be able to help you stop smoking. I know one of the guys in the groups was an avid nicotine vapor, and then he started vaping these, and now he doesn't take any nicotine at all.
Yeah.
So I think it works. And also, can we create a brand? Can Chill, through Chill Zero, through chill.com, through all of the Chill things, create a brand? If it can, then, you know, shareholders of Chill are going to get very rich, I think. That's my view.
Yeah. Well, after the AGM I attended, it was quite interesting. I went to an investor's evening with Panther Metals, Fulcrum Metals as well, and caught up with Aidan O'Hara and Darren Hazelwood. And there's also First Class Metals. So it was like three miners, three junior exploration companies, all in one place. And it was like in Colt in St. Paul's in London. And they did a presentation and they had a bit of a Q&A. It was really good, actually, you know, just sort of short 20-minute presentation on each one. And pretty much within the Canada space, or they've all got assets within Canada, it just showed how promising it looks as a kind of mining jurisdiction, you know, the assets they've got there. So that was really, really nice way to spend a couple of hours. And so big shout out to those guys, that they look three companies who've got very, very exciting futures ahead.
Which were the three companies again?
So you've got Panther Metals, Palm is the ticker. Fulcrum, who've actually got an investment, who hold 20% of the company in Fulcrum. You know, we had Aidan on last week.
Yes, Panther owned part.
Panther owned Fulcrum. And then there was another company, FCM, which is First Class Metals. As I say, they've all got assets within Canada. So they were all kind of like working together, and they had a kind of like a Q&A session, and they were all bouncing ideas off each other.
And there was a big buzz about First Class Metals last year, wasn't there? And it really did do very well, and then it's come back down to earth with a bump, I think.
Yeah.
So
that was good, and there's quite a buzz around. It's a busy evening, met a lot of people there. Always good to get back into the city. So anyway, what else? I think we've gone on long enough. It's been a long one this week, but it's obviously nice to have a double header. Anything else you want to talk about for the weeks ahead?
Not really. I mean, next week we're gonna hopefully have a guest, but we're also gonna cover our three quarters, the third quarter, as in our portfolio, how it's doing. So watch out for that. All the stocks that we covered, the 12 plus the 5 golden rings, which haven't been very golden at this point. So we will do that next week. And not really. I mean, economically, I think the world's coming to rights with what's actually happening. I still can't understand how on earth the US dollar is suddenly become stronger again over the last month or so. So I predict myself that the US dollar's got to nosedive. But other than that, no. I mean, the markets seem pretty good. I think we're in for a good few months, to be honest. But I've said that multiple times before and it hasn't happened. So we'll see.
Good. Well, thanks for listening. And if you like what you've heard, hit the subscribe and bell icon so you get warned of any notifications for any future podcasts that we do. Thanks for listening again.
Yep. Thanks, guys.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.